use this way in to kind of introduce the book and to talk a little bit about sources. I always think it's interesting to understand a little bit about someone's, how they got to where they are, you know, so hopefully you'll find that interesting as well. So I suppose this is the long origins of the book. So the cover of the book is on the right-hand side there. I put it slightly bigger, Sport and Home Front, published in 2020. And the origins go back actually to my first academic publication, which was in this edited volume called War Culture, published by Pat Kirkham was a design historian when I was doing my PhD at De Montfort, and David Toms was a historian of industry, and he'd written about the Second World War, and they put together this collection. At the time, my PhD didn't include the Second World War, but together with Piano Franchi, who was my supervisor, we wrote a piece. They asked, you know, can you write a piece on football, and we tried. We did what we could, but I think there are a couple of things in the course of doing it that became quite clear to me, that there hadn't been a great deal written, either by academics or in kind of popular histories, about the significance and role of sport in British wartime society. The second point, which became very clear, is that what had been written was quite simplistic and unsophisticated, I thought. So I'll come back to it later on. And an example of this is, I just wanted to show a quote which everyone uses, partly because, and this is the way in which quotes sometimes work their way through history books and things like this. This is a book which was used by James Woolvin in kind of one of the first books on the history of British football. It's still an interesting book, but some that people would think kind of it's been superseded now. But he actually used a very, very small amount in that book about the Second World War, but he uses this quote. Sports, I know you can read it, but I'll just quickly say, you know, sports like football have an absolute major effect on the morale of the people, and one Saturday afternoon of league matches could probably do more to affect the people's spirits than the recent £50,000 government poster campaign urging cheerfulness. Okay, so Woolvin got that quotation from a book, another book published at the time called War Begins at Home, which was put together by the social research organisation Mass Observation. I'm going to come back to them in a minute because they're quite important. And that quotation has been used by lots of people, including myself and Pierre used it as well. We were desperately trying to find material. There wasn't a great deal at the time. And I think it was useful. It gives an idea of how enlightened the government was during the Second World War compared with the First World War. And the fact that there was more official support for sports clubs and associations than during the First World War. But actually, it's a quote which masks a much more complicated reality. And even Mass Observation itself, their views about sport were far more complex than this quotation suggests. The quotation was just used in isolation by Woolvin, and to be honest, was by us in our article as well. Okay, so I sort of part this, I finished my PhD, you know, I did the things that Amanda suggested, kind of published things on football, and I came back to it when I was looking for a project around about 2009 for my next project. In the meantime, I kind of kept abreast with what had been published in the area on sports history, I suppose, and Second World War. There'd been very little. There was an article by Norman Baker, a chapter in an edited book by Norman Baker, which was kind of partly on sport in Britain in the Second World War. Then there was a very good book, Tony Mason and Eliza Reedy's book on sport and the military in Britain. It has a chapter on the Second World War, but it really was about service personnel outside Britain. It actually didn't really deal with what I wanted to look at, which was, in a way, the home front, what happened within Britain itself and how sport connected to that. So there hadn't been a lot of movement in sports history. There'd been a lot of movement, though, in the social and cultural history of sport that had really developed in that period, to the point where you had now lots of work on what you might call entertainment, recreation, and popular culture. There's lots of books on cinema. I mean, cinema had long been a key topic. Lots of great book on music in the Second World War on the BBC. Great stuff on art. And increasingly, there was work on dance, theatre, even an excellent article on the circus in wartime. So in comparison to all those are really important things and help us to understand, I think, the social and cultural history of this incredible period in time. But the gap of sport seemed even more conspicuous and obvious to me, you know, over 10 years later when I started considering coming back to this idea. So what I did is I began to hunt around, see whether there was a story that could be told. My intention, and that's what I'm going to start with now, was to start with official government sources. What is there in the National Archives? Is there much there? And to kind of go from the centre outwards, if you want, to then look at local sources. And then I always wanted, a big part of the book, and I'm going to talk about that later, was always going to be looking at the individual, at personal sources. Okay, and so that's what I really want to do in the remainder of the talk. I want to take you through some of the sources I've used, some of the discoveries I made, and some of the arguments that I kind of developed. Sorry, and I want to do this by exploring three areas. Firstly, the government and sport. That's one. Then I want to talk about personal narratives, and then I want to finish by looking at women, war and sport, which kind of is something which is underpins lots of different aspects of the book, but doesn't have its separate chapter. And I wanted it to be that way. Okay, so government and sport. I want to start by talking a little bit about that. I've just listed here the material that I found in the end in the National Archives. It's a big part of the book, okay? But when I initially went searching, I would have had no idea that I would have found so much, because when you search on Discovery, the National Archives site, hardly anything comes up with the name sport or a type of sport. Basically, there's about five or six key files, okay? And I'm going to talk about those five or six files because that's where I started. But what in the course of the research, as kind of all of us kind of do, and we find that actually you look in different ways and you kind of look, well, you know, I began to realize how important sport was in terms of the government's welfare program in factories. So actually there's lots on welfare. And within that, there was lots and lots of material on fitness, sport and things like this. So sport itself, what it shows, I think, is how sport obviously sits alongside lots of other ideas and lots of other themes. And it's so clear in something like this, because even when you're searching for the material, that's clearly the case. So I started with the bit that I put in red here, the Home Office files, which looked at sport. And what I found initially was that there were a number of files related mainly to three different sports. Football, which we shouldn't be surprised, I suppose, that was recognised as the most popular sport amongst working people, and particularly amongst war workers and the military, you know, the armed services, so people in the military. But the other two files or groups of files that existed were in relation to slightly different sports, gambling sports, so horse racing and greyhound racing. And what you could do, and what I began to do by looking at those, was actually begin to understand the timeline and the subtleties of government policy in relation to sport. Because what I realised straight away is that we didn't even know, I don't think, what government policy was in relation to sport. I think people recognised that the government was more accommodating to sport in the Second World War in Britain than it had been in the First. You know, things had changed by then. Sport had become much more embedded in British popular culture. But the actual intricacies of policy, no one had even bothered to look at. I don't think they were interested necessarily. And that's one of the things I wanted to do. And what it allowed me, I think, to say is that government attitudes to sport weren't static and singular, but they were dynamic and plural. You know, they were much more complex than you might initially think. And so I just want to sort of flag up three ways in which they were more complex. And the first and obvious one is that they changed over time, I suppose. So there were certain periods during the war, and I've kind of listed some of those there, the summer and autumn of 1940, which coincided with the big crisis in kind of the Allied, in the war, and kind of the Allied, the fall of France. In Britain, the whole of that period was dominated by the invasion scare, the kind of fear that there was going to be an imminent invasion from Germany. Then you had the summer of 1941, which was another period of concern. The early part of 1942, which again coincided with defeats in the war, particularly the fall of Singapore. And finally, in early 1944, which was the context for that, was really the preparations for D-Day, for the D-Day invasion. In those periods, the government, particularly the war cabinet, the question of what to do with sport came before the war cabinet, which was the highest kind of policy making process. And in each case, the question was put, shall we ban sports entirely? In each case, they decided not to. They made some sorts of restrictions at various times, though. So in 1942 was kind of the biggest crisis moment for sport. It coincided with a very famous speech that was made by a government politician called Sir Stafford Cripps, very popular, a member of the Labour Party, but there was a national government in wartime. And it was widely reported in the newspapers. He basically said, you know, we need to take the war much more seriously, and certain trivialities need to be stopped. And he focused on particularly sports, and particularly greyhound racing and boxing. And there had been reports in the newspapers of a boxing match at the Albert Hall in London, where lots of war workers had attended. And this was reported by the Daily Express and the Daily Mail. And, you know, and they were saying, well, how can we possibly win the war if we're not actually going to be at work to produce the armaments and issues like this? So it became connected to this much bigger public debate about the seriousness of the war effort. And that led to restrictions. It led, for instance, to one form of horse racing in Britain, national hunt racing. So horse racing over hurdles was banned for a number of years in the war. And greyhound racing was limited to certain days and to a limited number of hours. Okay, so there were restrictions, but the important thing is that it changed over time, and government attitudes changed over time. The second kind of factor in which it depended was simply on what sport we're talking about. Okay, so broadly speaking, government departments were very, very accommodating to football. It was recognised how important it was, how popular it was, and how important it was to the working class. They were less supportive to horse racing and greyhound racing. Both of those sports had a fairly dubious position because they were associated with gambling. However, there was a slight difference between them. Horse racing had its defenders in government, and the most important one was Churchill. Churchill never concerned himself a great deal with domestic policy. That's well established. But he was known to be he was a big fan of horse racing. He played polo in his youth. He was a lover of horses. He was a keen race goer. There's a picture of him there on the left hand side. So obviously after the war in 1951, so he owned race horses. Also, the horse racing authorities, particularly the two bodies that ran horse racing, the Jockey Club and the National Hunt Committee, were run by wealthy members of the aristocratic elite. And they often had very close connections with the political establishment. So the two people who negotiated for the horse racing authorities with the government were both lords. They were members of the House of Lords, Lords Rosebery and Lord Harewood. And so they had a very influential position. If you compare that to greyhound racing, and I've put a picture of a greyhound racing crowd there from the war. Greyhound racing was a much, much younger sport. It was associated with gambling. It was associated in many people's minds with a kind of negative Americanization, because it was linked to an idea of sports which weren't traditional and were linked to razzmatazz and things which weren't, you know, weren't at core English or British. And so there was much more criticism of greyhound racing, and the greyhound racing authorities found it much more difficult to make their case. So the sport was another factor. And the third factor was simply that no one had really understood before, but is so important in understanding the way in which the wartime government worked, were kind of conflicts between different ministries and different departments during the war. I mean, we know that happens in governments, you know, we know that's the case, but there has tended to be quite a simple view of there was a government opinion, and that certainly wasn't the case. I put a very simplistic kind of diagram here, pro-sport on one side, anti-sport on the other side. Obviously, things are much more complex than that, and actually there were more government ministries involved in the decisions. But probably the four most important were the Home Office, which was basically in charge of security issues, which was the key, all the material, as I've said, in relation to whether sports should continue or not. It was the Home Office which was a central ministry who made those decisions. But they asked the view of others. And the Ministry of Labour and the Service Ministries and the Ministry of War Transport were probably three most important. And the most pro-sport was the Ministry of Labour. They always made a very strong case for how important sport was for the relaxation for munition workers, and how actually sport was crucial for keeping up production levels. Okay. The Home Office tended to be supportive. And so did the service ministries, except at certain periods. The most critical was the Ministry of War Transport, particularly towards the end of the war. And they focused on particular kind of logistical issues. The fact that crowds going to horse racing and the transport of horses could affect the movement of military personnel and other key factors. But individuals are important as well. And it's quite ironic that the key figure who was kind of anti-sport in the wartime government, throughout the wartime government, was this person here, Philip Noel Baker. And he was a parliamentary undersecretary at the Ministry of War Transport, you know, a fairly senior figure in that department. Also, he happened to be a former Olympian. He was a track and field medalist in 1920. He became the kind of unofficial, there wasn't a minister of sport in Britain until the 60s, but the unofficial minister of sport was Noel Baker in the 1940s. Yet he was the most vocal opponent, particularly of horse racing. He was the key figure who opposed, you know, most of the intentions of the horse racing authorities to increase the number of events. Okay. And the reasons for that were, as I said, operational, but also psychological, you know, and there were lots of reports of workers who were unable to go in time to their factories and things like that because they were left on railway platforms because overcrowding from people going to the races. And so there were lots of examples of that. So ultimately, Noel Baker and the Ministry of War Transport wasn't able to kind of unbalance the weight of pro-sport opinion. And they were also actually hampered by the fact that for much of the war, transport carried less influence than the other ministries. So that's another key point. The Ministry of War Transport wasn't represented in Churchill's war cabinet, which was a key kind of indication of the prestige of different departments. And that probably meant that the criticism of sport was a bit muted and kind of kept to the margins. Okay, so that's the first thing I wanted to talk a little bit about. Talked a bit longer than I wanted to, but I'll try not to try to get everything else in. The second one was the key thing I wanted to do in the book was talk about individual experiences. Okay, I never wanted this to be a top-down institutional account, despite what I started talking about today. And one of the key arguments in the book was that sports wartime significance kind of was based in its contribution to the everyday lives and routines of British people at this kind of period of mass threat and anxiety. And luckily enough, the wartime period is one where there are rich, in Britain, there are rich personal sources. And I just want to talk about two of those. Mass observation, and then I'll talk a little about the Imperial War Museum collections. So mass observation is one of my favorite sources, and I use a lot in lots of the work I do, and it's central to this book. So just very briefly, Mass Observation was a social research organization founded in 1937 by three left-wing intellectuals. And two of those men are pictured there. On the left is a chap called Tom Harrison, who was an anthropologist, and Charles Madge on the right, who was a poet and a journalist. Now, among other things, they established a group of volunteers called the National Panel. And what the National Panel did, they were interested in mass observation, they volunteered, and they were sent every month questionnaires, which were called directives. And they were asked various things about what their view was about particular political decisions in the war, but they were also asked things about their cultural lives and their everyday lives, a range of things mass observation was interested in. And so I've used a lot of the mass observation material. Luckily enough, there were a couple of these directives which were specifically on sport. And there was one in March 1942. You may remember this was one of the periods where there was lots of concern about the use of resources and whether something like sport should continue. So the panel were asked two questions: should organized sport continue? And also how to what extent the war affected their personal attitude to sport. Now, interestingly enough, the second question was ignored at the time, because mass observation was employed by the government. So it kind of contributed to the government understanding, you know, that how people were feeling and their morale during the war. But this second question actually has got some incredibly rare and colourful evidence, not just about how war impacted people's sports activity, but people basically gave potted personal sporting histories. And they talked about what sport meant to them. And so you've got some really rare material, actually, which allows us to answer some of the things I wanted to know about what sport meant and how it affected people's personal narratives of their lives, really, at wartime. And what you get from these replies, and there are hundreds of them, there's about 300, something like that, some of them very short, some of them 4 or 5 pages long, some longer. And people talk about, you know, things like what sport means to them. Is it a form of exercise, a form of relaxation, pleasure? They talk about whether they feel it's the right thing to do to play and watch sport at wartime. But they also sometimes talk about wider kind of emotions, and it kind of connects to the emotional history of the war, I think, as well. And just one or two very brief examples. This is one that I use in the book. This is one of the diarists. So I use the National Panel answer these directives, but they also, many of them, kept diaries. And this is a diary of a young army officer. And he talked about his wider feelings of guilt. He attended a famous horse races at Ascot in June 1944. And he said, well, basically, I enjoyed it, but I felt incredibly guilty. And then he goes on to, he talks about this for a number of pages. You know, I enjoyed it. I got to see my friends, some of my friends, but I can't help feeling uncomfortable. What am I to do? He says, so this is just a quote, sit in camp all afternoon with my revolver by my side, looking for a German paratrooper. I'm sure the Second Front will go no better for that. But all the same, the guilty feeling persists. And it links to a wider sense of his guilt. Why should I be staying in England in a soft job? He's in the army, but he's been at home the whole of the war. 6 miles from home when half my friends are overseas in the thick of it. So it kind of links, I think, to the way in which I was able, hopefully, to tap into the emotional history of individuals as well. One of the other really important sources I used, or sets of sources, was from the Imperial War Museum. And there's some great stuff there. There's a sound archive, there's letters, diaries, oral testimonies. Some really interesting stuff I found was in the collections of someone called Peter Buchanan, who was, again, a private in the British Army. But he was abroad. He was in North Africa and Italy during 1943 and 44. And the collection has letters that were written to him by his mother, his sister, and his father. And what they reveal, again, is something of the emotional history of families, but the way in which something like sport taps into that. So, for instance, his letters from his father, they don't discuss the war at all. There was censorship as well. They're all about horse racing. They're about trips to the races, listening to races, betting odds. And it's really interesting because what you see is that through these, what his father was really doing was evoking memories of home and really expressing intimacy to his son. That's what this is all about. You know, so sport is a vehicle for confronting emotions and family emotions. Okay, and there's other great examples here. I've got a copy of a book there, which was actually published, but I found those diaries initially and then they became published by a school teacher from Derbyshire called May Smith. Again, very little about sport, but her local tennis club features the whole time. It's the centre of her life during the summer. It's where she engages in gossip, where she talks about politics, where she meets her future husband, who is a wartime doubles partner. And another one is a mass observation diary of the mass observation diaries are anonymous, so we don't know the name, but he's a middle-aged electrician from Blackburn. And his big sport is bowls, so green bowling, very popular in parts of England. And again, the bowling is the place where it's a repetitive activity, but where really his morale and well-being and his sense of self become clear, because he talks in his diary about with the people he plays with, talking about religion, morality, and the sorts of topics which are probably going to be out of bounds for men of his particular generation and age. But he manages to do that in a sporting context. It becomes acceptable. And he includes some of that in his diary. Okay. So the final thing, I've talked a bit longer than I intended to, but I do want to talk about this part. It's really important. This links, I think, to my final part of this talk, which is the role of women in the book. Okay. These photos, by the way, they're photos of wartime netball. And netball features quite a lot in the book. And the picture of the portrait of the woman there is a swimmer called Nancy Riack, who's a Scottish swimmer and is probably the best known wartime swimmer of either gender. So from an early part of my research, I knew that women were going to feature significantly in the book. And one of the reasons why is that most of the historical work on the British home front has focused on women, you know, because they are so important to the politics and social and cultural history of the time. But hardly any of that material has talked about sport and leisure. Women were integral to the British home front, not just, of course, as mothers and wives, but as workers in munitions factories and workers in civil defence and voluntary organisations. So their morale their welfare and their physical fitness mattered to those in authority more than ever before, I would argue. So in the book, and also even more in an article I've co-written since the book came out with Raf Nicholson, I've argued that the war had a significant influence on the sporting lives of British women. And I just want to give a couple of examples of that. Firstly, I think they were important in terms of how they linked to the British war machine. Between 1939 and 1943, 1.5 million women took up work in essential wartime industries. So the Ministry of Labour, which was in charge of these factories, put a great deal of emphasis on welfare, and they required all major employers to employ welfare officers, and local government welfare officers were appointed in every region of the country. And sport was a really important part of this big kind of what I call a welfare net. Okay. And it was through the factories, but also through organisations like the National Association of Girls Clubs, which really grew during the Second World War. And a really key organisation was the Central Council of Recreative Physical Training, which became the CCPR, quite an important post-war kind of leisure and sport body. And they were employed by the government to advise welfare officers, to run physical training classes, and to organise sport within factories and work hostels. And one significant thing about the CCRPT is that it was run by a woman. Picture I've got there of Phyllis Colson, who was the secretary of the CCRPT from the 1930s up to much later. I would say Colson was the second most important official in the kind of story of British wartime sport after Stanley Rouse, the FA secretary and the future FIFA secretary. Okay. And Labour officials were so concerned about morale and welfare, particularly of the women in wartime industry, that they placed more emphasis on women's recreation than they did on men's. So for instance, netball. Netball was the fastest growing participatory sport during the war. Large netball works leagues were established in cities where the concentration of female labour was high. So places like Coventry and Wolverhampton particularly, but also in a range of other cities. And you can see the growth of netball in the numbers there. In 1939, there were only 16,000 members of the All England Netball Association. By 1951, there were 3 million. And the war played a big part in that. And other sports also grew, women's sports, women's rugby rounders, even football, despite the fact that the British football associations were still technically opposed to women playing football. So that was really important. That was for kind of working class women. But I think it's also important to say the crucial leadership role that women played. At many sports clubs, middle class women particularly stepped into leadership roles. So we've got prominent examples like Nora Cleaver. I've got two pictures there of Nora Cleaver. She became the secretary of the All England Lawn Tennis Club in Wimbledon. Okay. But elsewhere it was happening everywhere. Mixed cycling, swimming and rowing clubs were often run by female secretaries during the war. In Northampton, for instance, which is a small town in the middle of England, there were 8 swimming clubs and they were all controlled by female officials in 1941. And I was lucky enough to use some great resources that allowed me to tell this story. And one example, just very quickly, was the Wimbledon Ladies Hockey Club, which was a very well-to-do club in the wealthy London suburb of Wimbledon, most known, of course, for tennis. And these records are held in the Hockey Museum in Woking. And what they show is in detail how the officials struggled to keep the club going despite the loss of players, despite financial problems and equipment and clothing shortages. But the really important thing was how these women viewed the club in relation to the war. They didn't see it in selfish terms as a way of providing sport and recreation to a small number of people. For them, carrying on was a patriotic act and a vital contribution to the war. So at the beginning of the war, it's really interesting. The club minutes talk about the fact that the committee was going to commit itself to going into action alongside the civilian and armed forces. That's how they saw their role. They compared their hockey club work with the actions of military personnel. And that demonstrated the place, I think, that sport had as an outlet for civilian duty in support of this total war effort. Okay, so I've nearly finished. Just very briefly in conclusion, there are other themes and things that you might want to ask me about. Chapter 3 in the book talks about connections between sport, space and locality. I have a section on BBC radio broadcasts. And the final chapter looks at the relationship between sport, war and ideas of Britishness. But if I was able to sum up just a key argument of the book, it would be this, that rather than representing an interval in the history of 20th century sport, I think the book shows that the Second World War actually reinforced and expanded sport's role in British cultural life. Sport reflected a kind of plurality of wartime experience. It could symbolise citizenship and patriotism at the same time as it symbolised the contradictions and divisions of life on the home front, and there was lots of that. But ultimately, I think sport mattered because to continue, to carry on, was a significant act which demonstrated commitment to one's club, to one's class and locality, and ultimately was linked to the nation itself and how the British saw themselves. Okay, thanks very much.